Hello and welcome back to Podcast from the Edge with me, Peter Bruce. Remember, we are available on the Financial Mail digital platform every Wednesday early. And quickly after that, you can find me on the Apple and Spotify podcast platforms as well. Thank you all so much for listening to these podcasts. I really appreciate it. I've asked my go-to trade and industry expert, Donald Mackay, to come back on the show, primarily after reading a report by XA Global Trade Advisors, where Donald is CEO. And Donald, thanks for coming back. Once again, you know, very grateful. Your report was titled, XA Launches Its Fourth Import Duty Investigation Report, and it's a doozy. So for listeners following us from abroad, it might be worth explaining that a doozy is a word implying a sort of significant amplification of importance or interest. And I think it's worth explaining, Donald, that you arrive at your analyses of our efforts to reindustrialize or just industrialize rather differently than from a merely sort of straight examination of the trade balance or industrial production. You start by looking at how the tools of trade are being used. You know, you're a bit like the sort of food tasters that kings used to use in the olden days, where you know you could taste something and tell him whether it was poisonous or rotten or good to eat. Why do you report on import duties, and what was it about this last report that made it a doozy?
Yeah, so this is our fourth edition of this report, and we really started the report because we were becoming concerned by how long it was taking for tariff investigations to finalize. So these are applications either for more or less duty on a product. And irrespective of which direction your application went in, they were taking longer and longer. That situation has now just become considerably worse than it was 2 years ago when we released our very first report. And the reason I've said it's a doozy this time is because the situation has deteriorated, not only relative to kind of where we were 2 years ago, but we've taken a view this time of the full 20 years that the International Trade Administration Commission's been in existence. And on literally every metric we looked at for the last 20 years, we've seen a material deterioration in performance. So it's extremely alarming, because the effect of all of this is that South Africa has, to all practical purposes, lost the use of tariff instruments, either to improve competitiveness by removing costs from the supply chain or asking for more protection when companies are struggling with foreign competition. And this is simply not a good state to be in.
So, sorry, Donald. Just tell me what's bad about the longer time. Let's say you want some protection. You ask the ITAC for it, the Department of Trade, Industry and Competition, and they take some time. And you can sort of see why that might hurt you. But the sort of overall impression, particularly of South African policy and approach to this sort of thing since Ebrahim Patel became Minister of Trade, Industry and Competition, was that there was lots of protection on offer. What am I missing?
Yes, so that is still the position, and probably more so, except what has happened is a very large cost has been attached to accessing that protection. So put differently, it's not the merits of your case that determines whether you can or can't get protection, but the whether you're prepared to meet the cost that government imposes on you getting that protection or reduced protection in the other direction. So they've made it very expensive to interact with these instruments, and seemingly for the vast majority of the market have simply opted out of interacting because of that.
And would that mean that people have simply gone out of business or no longer care? If you're asking for protection, presumably it's for a good reason. If you're not following up on it and just walking away, have you given up or have you found another way?
So I don't know the answer to that, because we don't know what happens to everyone after this. Certainly, anecdotally at least, we know that some companies are just not prepared to do it. So they would rather live with the whatever risks the market imposes or whatever costs their raw material inflation is pushed up by because of the duties. They would rather live with that than make a signed commitment. So the minister uses the analogy of a bring and buy, and he says, you know, you can't just come asking. You need to bring something with you as well. You can't just kind of consume the braai. But the problem is, at this point, nobody is prepared to go to the braai any longer, which means the rent that government is attempting to extract, there's simply nobody left to extract it from.
We'll come to that. We'll come to this in a moment. You start the report, one, simply by saying, you know, that there are a number of issues that are really problematic. And the two ones that I want to just talk about first. One, you're saying these investigations are too long. What is happening? Are we less competent than we used to be? Is there less pressure? Is it deliberate? Is it accidental? What do you think? Well, you've got all the experience.
There are two legs to this. There's a leg at ITAC, and there's a leg with the two ministers, the Minister of Trade and the Minister of Finance. Now, the ITAC performance has been fairly consistent over the 20 years. In fact, it's even improved over the 20-year period. The problem arises when it hits the two ministers. Now, we can't make a difference between, we can't see the difference when something left Minister Patel's desk and went to Minister Godongwana. All we can see is that the two ministers together are hogging most of the time. Now, this is peculiar because the bulk of the work is done by ITAC, but the bulk of the time is spent with the two ministers. I don't believe there's a lack of skills or any such thing. I think what has happened is the process has become politicized, whereas ITAC's job is to act independently. But I think the political interference in the process means that ITAC is disempowered to some degree, and that the true power behind these decisions is now sitting with the two politicians rather than with the administrator. And that is why there is a problem. That's my speculation, Peter.
And ITAC reports to and is appointed by Ibrahim Patel, the Minister of Trade, Industry and Competition. Is that right?
Yes, correct.
Okay. So, and the other issue that you raised was that, you know, once they've been made, you say that 93% of all import duties that are currently in place and on which duties were paid in 2023, last year, have not had their duties considered in more than 20 years. That's almost unbelievable. We've had the same import duties in place for 20 years or more.
Yeah, I was so shocked at that outcome that I asked my analyst, Annika, who did the hard work behind this report, to please double-check her calculations. But her calculations are spot on. This is a very bad situation to arrive at, because what we're doing is we're creating these eternal infants, you know, these companies that never graduate to being competitive. They simply remain protected behind customs duties in perpetuity. And by the way, when I say more than 20 years, many of them, we have no idea how long they've been in place for. You know, they certainly precede the democratic era. So you know, they could have been in place forever. Yeah.
And give us an example, if you have any to hand, on an import duty that would have been in place for 20 years. Who's benefiting here?
So the probably the biggest sector that benefits from this has been automotive. It's a complicated sector, but the automotive sector attracts very high duties. These are perhaps politically very sensitive, but they do need to be considered in light of the fact that they're also accompanied by the lion's share of South Africa's subsidies. So we have high levels of protection, we have very high levels of subsidies. And it would appear that we will never be in a position where we can ever remove those, which means we're making cars very expensive in South Africa. The subsidies don't benefit South African consumers. And the net effect is that we've got automotive sectors which will never be naturally competitive in South Africa. They will require support for as long as we make cars here.
So are we paying unnaturally high prices for imported cars?
Yes. We're also paying unnaturally high prices for the cars that are manufactured here, because there's no discount.
Well, that's because we subsidize them.
Yeah. So the subsidies and the duties create a bizarre outcome where the poor German consumer of the car is getting the car cheaper, while the wealthy Africans are paying a premium.
So take a BMW 3 Series in South Africa. We don't make the 3 Series in South Africa. We make the X3 and only the X3 in South Africa. So presumably the X3 we are paying indirectly through our taxes because it's a heavily subsidized undertaking. South African government pays BMW to make cars here. But the X3, the Series 3, which leaves Germany or wherever it's made, Mexico could be, what sort of duty does that have to, does that attract before I'm allowed to go and sit in one in a car dealership?
Yeah, so depending where it comes from, if it's out of the EU, it'll be 18%. If it's coming out of Japan, for example, it'll be 25%. So that's a big duty. And by the way, the X3 that you buy in South Africa would be sold at import parity price. In other words, it would be sold as if it was imported, not as if it was produced locally. So it simply inflates.
That's BMW's call.
Yes.
Yeah. And then, Donald, the investigation is taking too long. The duties remain in place for too long, and as you say, create this sort of rather sort of Jabba the Hutt kind of fat lazy picture of South African industry. But that's not enough for the government, because they've also introduced over the past few years, if you want to import something because it's important to your business, that you have to make some sort of you sign a sort of reciprocal agreement with the state where they say, well, okay, we'll allow you to import X, but we want Y from you, which sounds to me like, sort of form of racketeering almost.
Yeah, so I wouldn't use quite as strong a word, but I guess it's not too far off the mark. I mean, I think the noble intention behind all of this is that where government's view is we need to create more production locally. But the problem you have is you're now saying to somebody who imports a raw material, we want you to make a commitment. We'll give you duty relief while there's no production, but the minute there is production, you have to stop importing. Now, the problem with that is that it presumes the South African producer, who in many cases doesn't exist yet, will be able to produce the product as competitively to the same standards, all the rest of it. And again, the problem with this kind of thinking is we're sort of trying to fix the unemployment one job at a time. You must contract to get this benefit. You must agree to employ 10 people or 50 people, whatever the number is. You can't put a dent into unemployment by contracting people to employ small numbers at a time. So the cost of doing this has been, for example, a company would find they're under obligation to sign a contract for this one raw material, but a much bigger investment, which is unrelated to this product, gets put on hold because they've had an unpleasant experience with this. So you've created 20 jobs in the process of doing this, but you've stopped 100 million rand investment happening because the interaction was unpleasant. And this is the challenge. So where the much bigger areas where they don't need government support are not seen in all of this. And that's obviously problematic.
So let's try and think of a scenario where this would happen. I know, because I remember seeing it during maybe two years ago, a letter basically of a sort of reciprocal agreement where somebody had applied for an import a license or a rebate on something they were importing, and the DTI or ITAC had written to them to say, well, we'll allow you to do that, but we want you to provide 50 jobs in return, right? And the company who signed off, did one of those things, was then obliged to make that investment, as you say, and also, you know, in order to get the product, the import that they want, which might have just been to complete, you know, a mix of whatever it was, paint or gravy or cement or whatever, in whatever product that they happen to be selling. It's just what's so interesting now is that not only is Minister Patel asking new applicants for job creation, he's also requiring them, as you say, to promise, once he has created a supplier of whatever it is that you want to import, that you have to buy from them and stop importing what he's about to allow you to import. And when I talked earlier on about racketeering, that's what protection is. You know, if you watch the Sopranos, it's the way the mafia operates. They come along to your corner shop and tell you they want, you know, they want $100 a month or a week from you for whatever, you know, for protection money. And pretty soon you get in deeper and deeper. So we now have companies having to sign off irrevocable commitments to the government that if, and I presume this has all got to do with the Black Industrialist Program that President Ramaphosa spoke about, I think it was at the State of the Nation address or at the launch of the party's manifesto, 1,000 Black industrialists formed and another 1,000 to come. In fact, his performance agreement with Minister Patel required him to localize the production or identify 1,000 products to localize. Anyway, so we now have a whole new policy. We were job creating, and now we're Black industrialists creating, and the guys getting stick for it or having to do the promising aren't big business necessarily, not BMW or Anglo, but little guys further down the ladder who just want to, you know, want to import something fairly small and insignificant. It might even be a generator. And they've been stuck with a demand from the government, which, as you say, you know, I mean, you'd want to walk away from it if you could, but some people presumably can't. It's an awful situation.
Yeah, I mean, it is. But what it's doing is it's creating an incredibly rigid environment at a time when flexibility is required. So we're at a time of tremendous economic distress. The last thing you want is government in the boardroom of, you know, all the different companies trying to micromanage how they should take strategic decisions. So that's the effect of this. You know, we're saying to somebody, we think you would be better off buying this raw material from a company we will assure you will be there because the IDC is going to fund them. You would be better off buying from them. And you need to make that commitment blind, by the way, Peter. So you don't know who they are. They don't participate in the ITAC investigation, but you have to make this commitment without knowing who they are. You know, if you just kind of multiply that out, if you're inviting government into your boardroom, we're kind of transferring the efficiency of state-owned enterprises into the private sector.
Take a step back. Explain to me how the government gets into your boardroom.
Well, procurement, I think most people would recognize, is an important strategic function in a company. Your business is only ever as good as the stuff that you can buy competitively. If government intervenes, not only with nudges in the form of duties, but forcing you to contract into commitments, the effect of that is that government is taking a strategic procurement decision for you, should you sign off.
And that's problematic. And so it's making you commit to something completely unknown. and without any time frame. It could be next week, it could be next year, or never. But your letter lies there, throbbing away on somebody's desk at the DTRC. Donald, what sort of business? So let's come back to the sort of black industrialist idea. And you know, on one hand, so there's a sort of three layers of our industry at the moment. It's a big industry, it was big established, the big companies, they're all on the stock market, et cetera, most of them. There's a sort of layer which is quite large, I suspect, of very small, probably largely white-owned companies around the country. They make fences or poles or dresses or whatever, foodstuffs, colorings, flavors, whatever. And they've been around for a long time, and they're established, and they have their clients and their customers all around the country. And then since about 10 years ago, Jacob Zuma came up with this notion of creating black industrialists, which I always thought was weird because there weren't really even any white industrialists really left in the country. I mean, depending on how you define an industrialist, but you know, all the big brain industrialists have done their job here, and probably in most cases no longer with us. But you know, to the extent that the conceit, I thought, of thinking that you could simply create an industrialist or a manufacturer simply by giving him some money, which the IDC has, and I think you've mentioned before in this program that they've extended about 14 billion rand so far into the Black Industrialist Program of subsidy and assistance. They are going to create, if they're successful, an entire generation of totally government-dependent businessmen, not necessarily industrialists, but people who are living very fragile lives, where the government will find you export contracts, the government will find you local customers, the government will lend you money, or governments take business delegations with them, I know, when they go on overseas trips. But this is surely not going to end well.
No, so we're creating an incredibly fragile structure. You know, firstly, governments don't create business opportunities. I think there is a role to play for government to help nurture sectors, etc. But the problem here is that you can't go, the objective is to create 1,000 black industrialists. I mean, for that matter, if you're going to do that, you know, why not create 5,000 or 10,000? It's, yeah. The issue is, what we've got to do is create a competitive environment. And South Africa has an unusually uncompetitive environment. You know, not helped along by the likes of Eskom and Transnet. But even before that, before those kind of problems really emerged, we've always had a low productivity environment. We have labor laws which are not conducive to high productivity levels. We're far away from important markets. We're doing very little to overcome those costs that we need to. We have very poor levels of education in South Africa for the vast majority of the population. For the small amount that can afford a good education, all is good. But for the vast majority of people, we're not setting them up to be productive. And that's an enormous problem. So you can't overcome that by inserting government at the end of that process. You know, it's... you might recall, Peter, when Fikile Mbalula was Minister of Sport, and he said, look, what we've got to do is we're going to put quotas into the Springbok rugby team, without addressing the underlying problem, which is that lots of potential black players didn't have access to facilities and all the rest of it. So you can't fix the Springbok rugby team by inserting a quota, and you can't fix black industrialization without remedying a completely wrecked education system.
What's the right way to go about this? Look, I mean, you're absolutely right, and I grew up in a house where my father was an entrepreneur. He was a building contractor, and he worked very hard, and he brought work home at night, but we grew up well, and we lived very comfortably, and he obviously had the great advantage of being in business in South Africa is that his labor was dirt cheap. And that no longer applies. And there's a small question of, I suppose, justice in some way for all those years of oppression and just deprivation. What's the right way? What would be the sort of, I don't know, the market-friendly way or the liberal way to address economic inequality or industrial inequality and not stuff it up in the clear way, or not create a generation of people who don't know how to look after themselves without the government holding their hand? What would you do if you were given the job of, you know, sorting out our industry and our productivity?
Firstly, I should not be given the job. That's a terrible idea. But I think we undervalue the importance of the basics. And, you know, the real job of government, we can add other things on, but government's got to keep people safe. They've got to make sure that there is a way for contracts to be enforced, and they've got to make sure that markets are kept fair. Not that businesses should be favored or even pro-business, but it means that a pro-market stance is important so that monopolies, for example, don't develop and dominate. The challenge we've got in South Africa is government's trying to do too many things. And in part, that is because it perceives the market to not be addressing the inequalities that it needs to. Now, I would argue that we probably the most important thing we have not dealt with is our education system. And for as long as we care more about teacher unions than we do about pupils, we're going to have the outcomes that we have. So for as long as we're more concerned about keeping teachers happy who may be utterly incompetent in their job, we're going to find very poor outcomes. And this, sadly, is the position that we find ourselves in. Government in South Africa is the provider of a lot of our infrastructure. Government's allowed Eskom to end up where it has. It's allowed all of our railway lines to be stolen, et cetera, et cetera. The ports don't function. These are the jobs that government has to do well. And I would argue all of the resources that are being applied to fiddling with the little bits of micro policy that they are would be far better focused on how do we address the fact that each year only 50% of the kids that start school ever finish school. So forget what the matric pass rate looks like and all the rest of it. The much more important statistic is, why is it that half the kids never finish high school? Why is it that even people who finish high school can't read for meaning or do basic arithmetic? And you cannot build a productive economy if you don't address that. The economies are just an accumulation of all of the work and labor of everyone in that economy. And if the only thing you've enabled someone to do is spend their lives at a traffic light hoping to get picked up for a small building job, then that's an incredibly difficult way to get a productive economy working. So we have to address, how do we make South Africans more productive? And if we can't fix that, the idea that we can get GDP growth, you know, where's it going to come from?
There's another argument which says that it's not education so much that we lack as skills. And of course, you only get skills, not necessarily through education, but through active experience, learning how to do something next to somebody who already knows what they're doing. But even that we're not getting, because we are not attracting investment into new areas of the economy where we could learn something. We insist that instead of inviting the best producer of buttonholes in the world to come and invest in South Africa, we'll somehow do it ourselves. We'll make a black industrialist into the best buttonhole producer in South Africa and force all buttonhole customers to buy from them. It's a sort of hiding to nothing, whether it's education or skills. Donald, you mentioned in your report you had a few examples, real life examples of difficulty with ITAC and with the sort of trade instruments. And one that struck me was a company called Artsola, which I sort of know a little bit about. I think they have a factory in Pinetown near Durban. And they were a producer and still are, I think, one of the only surviving producers in South Africa of solar panels. And they applied back in March 2019, 5 years ago, for a duty increase on solar panels. In other words, presumably to protect them from outside competition. Is that right?
Yep.
And what happened?
Well nothing. They're still waiting. They have made history this month. In about 2 weeks' time, they will become the oldest open investigation in ITAC's history. So they'll hit 5 years old in March. We somewhat sarcastically put birthday candles on the front cover of our report to wish them a fifth birthday, but nothing has happened. Now, I have no idea. We're not involved with the case. My instinct is it's probably not a good idea to impose duties when we are so short of solar panels. And but nevertheless, whatever the case might be, I would argue Artsola deserved an answer to this. If their application has been rejected, they should be told it's been rejected. And if it's been accepted, then the duty increase must be put in. But this intermediate stage is horrible. It's also horrible for anyone else who might be thinking about investing and is waiting for the outcome. It's the worst of all worlds, and I don't think they should be in this position.
And what's interesting about Artsola, of course, is that it was sold by its original white owners to a black investment company not too long ago.
I did not know that.
Yes. Yeah. I think in 2023 or 2024, Artsola became a wholly black-owned company. And it still can't get its way through. You see, it didn't go through the right party channels. Didn't go through the DTI, didn't go through the IDC, the Industrial Development Corporation. I tried to do it all on its own and has been punished. And lastly, one of my favorite stories of yours concerns this lovely little butchery called the Matador Butchery, which is, if you were to translate it, would become the Butcher Butchery, in a small town called Somerset East in the Eastern Cape. They once employed 90 people back in 2010. Thanks to the DTIC or ITAC or the import regime generally, they're now down to 30 people with a few extras occasionally on a temporary basis. How are they going to survive? Can they do this? Can they make it? I can't remember the issue. They used to import deboned chicken, sort of leg quarters, and then on a 12% duty, then suddenly the duty went up to 42%.
Yeah, so I mean, when we put out the last report, they were employing less people. The only reason their numbers have gone up is they've introduced other product lines, which are unrelated to that, which have kind of compensated and allowed their numbers to lift. We still have no domestic producers of deboned chicken leg quarters. They still can't get the duty relief they've requested. So they've simply moved on to do other things now. And if the relief were given, they would love to get back into doing this, but it's simply not feasible for them.
And Donald, just come back to the premise, the original premise then of the report, where basically people have just given up on using the tools available to them, tariff tools available to them. What's the big so what?
Yes.
In answer to that problem?
There are two things. The one is these instruments are incredibly important, so important that they were the kind of foundational concept when the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade was formulated in 1947. So they were that important that the WTO as a whole agreement dealing with the management of duties. The problem we have in South Africa, because of the interference and the delays and everything else, private sector has simply stopped using the instruments. And that has two implications. One is businesses who are vulnerable to foreign competition lose the ability or the appetite to use these instruments because the cost imposed on them is too high. And so they'd rather live with the problem. There will be some of those that will shed some jobs, that will become less export competitive, whatever the case might be. The other irony of all of this is that the lack of interest in using these instruments also means that the ability to extract anything from these companies is completely diminished. So if the objective was that for each application that comes in, we can get them to commit to something, we're now at the lowest level in 20 years of private sector applications to ITAC. And, you know, I've never seen anything comparable to it, but we've effectively had the private sector almost completely withdraw from the process.
That's an extraordinary situation. On one hand, you have the private sector at a very high level, closely advising the president on sort of these three key reform issues, ESCOM, rail logistics, and security. And on the other hand, you have the private sector literally walking away from some of the key instruments in the hands of the state to help it do better business and to improve the lot of the country.
Absolutely. I mean, you mentioned something earlier, Peter, which may be worth revisiting. But in the late kind of 90s, South Africa brought out a whole lot of Taiwanese businessmen to look at what could be done to get the clothing industry off the ground. And a lot of that clothing manufacturing investment clustered around Newcastle. Due to a number of interventions in that space, that sector has largely disappeared now. So the irony is, with all of the interventions we've created in the clothing sector, our employment in clothing manufacturers halved since 2009. We've implemented policies which are designed to make sure our other SACU neighbors don't produce clothing in those markets. But combined with all of the labor laws plus the trade policy rules, what's happened is there's been an enormous relocation of productive capacity out of South Africa into those countries. So we've created a set of policies designed to grow jobs in the clothing sector, while the reality of that is that clothing manufacture employment has halved since 2009. So it's a dire situation. The interventions are very often having the opposite effect of the good intentions that they were founded on.
But nobody will question the wisdom of the people making these decisions. They're going to get voted back into office again on the 29th of May, and we move right along as if nothing had happened, I presume. Donald Mackay, thank you very much for joining me here again. I want to just give you an opportunity, if you'd like to remind people on how to follow you and XA Global Trade Advisory more closely, because you can subscribe to your work. How do they do that?
Well, they can visit our website and subscribe to our blog at xagta.com and on Twitter at xa_advisors. And you can get a sense of what we do.
Yeah. And I really advise anybody who's not already following Donald and his people at XA Trade Advisory, Global Trade Advisory, really to pay attention to what these guys are talking about. They are very, very good. And thank you for listening. I'll be back in 2 weeks. I'm moving house, a complete nightmare. Until then, stay safe and be good. Bye-bye.